Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. Coming up on the programme this week,
over 877,000 people in the UK are bereaved by suicide, at risk of dying by suicide, and we don't have the skills or the knowledge to care for these people.
38% of those bereaved by suicide have themselves considered suicide. And actually, in 8% of cases, there was a suicide attempt themselves. This idea that almost there is a contagion that comes around suicide.
The majority want to be approached, an offer of support. Let them decide if that's the right time. They shouldn't have to go on the internet looking all over for everything. They want a person to approach them, or a service that is fit for purpose, that understands their vulnerability and needs.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday. Welcome to the programme. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday once again. And thank you, as ever, to the community of people who support the programme and make it work through listening, taking part, suggesting topics, suggesting guest interviewees, and a million and one different things in between. Last week's edition was really successful with the team from Ripple, and a really important story to tell and to share as well. We wish her all the very best. Let's move on, though, to a different conversation now. And it's a revisit of a conversation I had more than 2 years ago, believe it or not. But suicide is still very much part of that conversation. And suicide has been on the agenda this week, off the back of the comments from Meghan Markle and her thoughts in regard to the situation she found herself in within the royal family. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole nonsense around things that were said on national TV, but it was good to see that there was an incredible amount of sympathy towards Meghan Markle in the main, and also organisations, many of whom have appeared on this programme, taking the opportunity to talk about what to talk about when someone mentions feelings of suicide to you. And there are things that you can say that are the right things to say. There are also things, Piers Morgan, that you will say that are the wrong things to say as well. So I'm glad that those organisations took the opportunity to talk about suicide responsibly. And hopefully that's something we can continue to do here at Mental Health Monday. Dr. Sharon McDonnell is with us on the programme this week. Now, Dr. Sharon was with us because she was gathering evidence for a report that she was writing through the University of Manchester. She's the Managing Director of Suicide Bereavement UK, and she's an Honorary Research Fellow at the University of Manchester. And she wanted to build the biggest report yet, setting out the lived experience of those who've been bereaved by suicide. What is it that you actually go through? What is the help and support that you actually need? And how can we make sure that that help and support is available? And the conversation's a fascinating one with Dr. Sharon, because now she has had those conversations, more than 7,000 of them. Many people who listen to the Mental Health Monday, by the way, took part in that survey. And she's written that report and is now hoping that that report can start to set the national agenda in regard to response to suicide. She's an absolute firecracker of a guest, by the way, as you're about to find out when I welcomed her back to the studio on Mental Health Monday.
Thank you. It's over 2 years now since we last spoke. So thank you for inviting me back on to tell you a bit more about the report and everything, because I was thrilled that you actually invited us onto your station to help recruit. So we had no findings, we had nothing to tell you, but actually you reached out to your listeners, because we had we wanted to recruit 7,000 people and we were so near, but you know, about 300 people off. And then when we took part on your when you interviewed me, you had your listeners stood up and they took part. And this survey, the suicide bereavement survey that we was conducting, wasn't a one pager, 72 questions and difficult questions, but they stepped up and we managed to recruit 7,158 people, making it the largest suicide bereavement survey internationally.
Which is an incredible achievement in and of itself. And that's before we get into the work you've been able to do in terms of the responses. And I think there's a fascinating conversation to be had here. The report is called From Grief to Hope, the Collective Voice of Those Bereaved or Affected by Suicide in the UK. Dr. Sharon McDonnell has been very much the driving force behind it, but a huge team around making it work as well. Before we get into what was found, can you just remind us of what you were hoping to achieve? What were the aims of having these conversations?
So what I will do, I will tell you a bit of a backdrop so you understand the importance of this study. So, okay, suicide, the economic cost, this is research on this, the economic cost of suicide is £1.7 million. This is, 60% of that cost is caring for those bereaved by suicide. 6,500 people die by suicide, but we know, evidence tells us now, 135 people are impacted. These people are also, we know, are at risk of dying by suicide. So each year, over 877,000 people in the UK are bereaved by suicide, at risk of dying by suicide, and we don't have the skills or the knowledge to care for these people. So caring for those bereaved by suicide is recognised as a key aspect of suicide prevention, and it's a government priority to support people bereaved by suicide. But prior to this report, we have some understanding, but if we wanted to look at the research, we had to go to other countries to tell us how to look after our people. Well, that's not good enough. So this is what we did. Our team, in our spare time as well, stood up, took us 6 years to do it, and we've led this study. And what I love about this is, you know, we wanted to understand their experiences and the perceived needs. And when there's a problem, sometimes the solution's in the problem. Just ask. And we did. And we dared ask. We had some really difficult questions. And because we dared ask, they knew we were bereaved. They knew it was coming from a good place. They dared answer. This report, and I want to tell you listeners, is shocking, but extremely powerful. And what is really special about it is, you know, we know those bereaved or affected by suicide. So affected is the professionals that look after us, for example. They're a hard to reach, hard to engage population. But let me tell you, you go about it the right way, they're there. You can't see the wood for the trees. And the majority of these people have been recruited thanks to people like you. Because I've got to say, I've been thinking about this before coming on, radio stations are an underutilized resource for suicide prevention, you know, and the work you do is amazing. So radio was on BBC Breakfast, but the majority were recruited on Twitter, and the men were recruited by the help of Neville Southall, who just embraced this. So this is more than a study. It's these people are finding the voice, and they want and now expect to be heard. And it's thanks to people like you that are giving us that platform that hopefully people of authority, power and with money might just listen, and it'll make a difference.
That's very kind of you to say, and actually, but testament to the hard work that you were putting in, that people sort of saw you as a figure that they could put their trust in as well, that they saw that was a way forward, that they could speak in a safe way, in a way that they thought, I'll be listened to, and actually what I say can be taken forward. Can I, in terms of the study and the results of it, I think there's a fundamental shift here that people will have when they read it, if they know nothing about suicide. And I think there is a preconception and misconception around suicide that it is somehow the end of pain, or it's the end of a journey, or it's the end of a story. But actually, there's a great deal of information that goes to show that actually that pain does not stop at suicide. That pain is transferred, that pain is moved elsewhere, that pain is put upon different people in many, many different ways, and in ways which I think people would be very surprised to hear. It almost fundamentally, I think, changes, for those who don't currently know, our understanding of the impact of suicide, that I think there is still a danger, and I think it's a big danger, that we almost romanticize the end of somebody's life by suicide as the end of their journey or the end of their pain. Actually, your report puts it in very, very clear focus that suicide doesn't bring about the end of pain. It moves the pain to other people and affects them in different ways.
So powerful what you've just said there. And there's a quote, I can't remember it exactly, but it goes a bit like this, that for all the pain and suffering stops for that person, it goes into the emotional closet of the bereaved. And I would say what you're saying, and actually in simple terms, the baton is passed. And, you know, we don't look after these bereaved who are stigmatised, isolated. We don't know how to look after them. It's almost like a conveyor belt. These vulnerable people, you know, and so you're absolutely right. And this is what's so powerful, powerful about this report, because we did ask difficult questions. We asked them, you know, we've learned about the high risk behaviour they're engaging in. And rather than having a tick box, oh, do you do this? Do you do that? We ask. We didn't insult them by giving them 20 characters to respond. If they wanted to write a page and a half, well, that was fine. But what they did, they told us what they were doing, and we didn't ask them this question, but because they had the space, they told us why they were engaging in things. So this is really powerful stuff for clinicians and policymakers that is absolutely priceless. But I think what really comes out of this that's really powerful, it's the collective voice, because there's two sides to a coin. You've got the bereaved, the vulnerable, but also you've got those that come into contact with us, the health professionals that have lost a patient, the emergency services that have to deal with it, you know, all of these, they come with their vulnerabilities. They're recognised as a high-risk group. And if you're going to change anything, you have to understand both perspectives, because let me tell you that because they're anonymous, they're telling us how it is, and we won't dilute. You know, that report is the first step in telling society what it's like. We will publish many papers that are as powerful as that report.
And in terms of those consequences that people might not instantly associate with suicide and somebody dying by suicide, relationship breakups, unemployment, financial problems. These are things that we associate with, you know, poor economic times or various other, or the coronavirus, you know, in fact. One in five reporting a deterioration in physical health. One in three developing a mental health problem. It just goes to show that the response to suicide is myriad, and actually it can impact in people's lives in many, many different ways.
Well, this is it. I think I'm putting some things in simple terms, you know, so, but, you know, and sort of tongue in cheek. I think we think mental health is, I think, which is a bit bizarre, that we're a human being and we have this floating head with all the mental stuff going on. Don't think for one minute that it might have an impact on the rest of your body. But what this is, what we found with this is, and it makes sense. You know, the traumas they're exposed to, the difficulties, you know, this is, and the stuff that's in here, the physical problems that these people are having. It's not that, you know, that some are turning to alcohol. The young ones are turning to unprescribed drugs, illegal drugs. The older ones, they're not going on the street looking for drugs. They're getting they're abusing prescribed drugs. So what has come out of this is absolutely powerful, we need a multi-agency approach. We don't just need the mental health professionals, because it is more complex than that. They have financial problems. If they've lost more than one, they're struggling to cope. And what I found out of all of these, some very powerful stuff, there's just so much to cover. Friends, we forget friends. The effort friends go to keep some of their friends alive is unreal and is powerful. And if you read this report, but what actually, there's a word called disenfranchised grief. And there's almost, which might sound bizarre, a hierarchy of grief. So everyone thinks, oh, the bereaved family need it, which they do. But, you know, then the friends think, oh, well, I'm not, this is not, you know, I'm not worthy of this support because I'm only a friend. And sometimes people love the friends more than some of the families, you know, and so as a society, we need to acknowledge that. We need to develop services that are fit for purpose. And that's kind of where we're at, I think. Multi-agency approach.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll come on to the recommendations of the report, because there's plenty in there, and there's lots to take stock of. In regard to that and the way that people respond when somebody's died by suicide close to them, it may be a friend, it may be a family member. I've heard it said many times that actually you are then at much higher risk yourself of considering suicide. And the stats that you found have borne that out to an extent to which I was surprised how high it was. 38% of those bereaved by suicide have themselves considered suicide. And actually in 8% of cases, there was a suicide attempt themselves. This idea that almost there is a contagion that comes around suicide, which is incredibly, I think, shocking. And also, maybe the first time that I've seen this borne out in statistics, that people will say that you're close to there, 1 in 10, 1 in 12 people who are bereaved by suicide, then attempting suicide themselves.
Yeah, so I think what's very powerful about this study, so there's research being done by Alexandra Pittman, and she was saying, you know, that actually the reality is these people, the distress they are exposed to fits in within the remit of psychiatric services, yet they're expected to go to the charities. Now, charities do an amazing work, absolutely, keeping these people alive. But that's the situation. So what this research has done, so you'll get these charities, you know, hardly any money, surviving from year to year, yet they've got the most vulnerable people, you know, keeping them alive, basically, some of these. And so what this study is doing, the charities are not shocked. I wasn't shocked, but now there's evidence to say that. So I think the good that will come from this, you know, this report, you can ignore it, but, you know, this, you can't ignore this report. And what is powerful, and you were saying it before about the people that feel this have emotionally invested in this, they don't want to be anonymous anymore. And you're absolutely right. I do believe on Twitter and the conference I do, they're emotionally invested in me and think that I will do something with it. I will desperately try. Do you know what I mean? So we're not going to be ignored anymore, whatever it takes. And it's people like yourself that dares talk about this topic that will help. We'll give our voice even a louder voice. But can I just talk about men?
Absolutely. Men are... We can talk about men. Absolutely, we can talk about men. Yeah. Because, again, when it comes to suicide, the stats are very clear. The stats are very obvious when that there is this weighting towards men more likely to die by suicide. I know many men took part in this survey as well. So just give us a sense of where you're at and how that sort of turned itself into your report.
Right. Tell you, society needs to get a grip and stop saying men can't talk, because let me tell you, provide the right society's failing men, not men failing themselves, you know, provide the right conditions on the top, and I'll give you an example. They might not be able to talk. I mean, when we say that, what are we saying to our young boys? You know, if you want to be a man, don't talk. So, you know, this cycle's still going. So anyway, when we've done this, you're anonymous, you say what you want. So professionals, they dare to say what they want. So the men, and you know, the what I've learned about men is, which is lovely, if they're anonymous and they think they're helping others, well, they'll do it. And ironically, they actually help themselves, but they don't do it for that reason. And I was analysing all the free text. So if you can imagine, you know, for one response, it would be like a page and a half. So I was reading these, I didn't know, who, men or women, who had said it. I couldn't separate the men or the women. They can write. They might struggle to talk, but let me tell you, they can write. And I think it, the biggest fundamental change is stop saying men can't talk and say, well, why are we failing men? What do men need that will help them? And again, ask them, because they'll probably tell you, rather than assuming. You know, sometimes we think a complex problem needs a complex solution. Just ask. I know that sounds really basic. No, I don't know.
I think, and actually, we were talking to the Samaritans on the program just a few weeks ago, and they were offering and issuing new guidance, having basically spoken to men who were engaging in service and saying, what was it that made you engage? And actually, it wasn't like you didn't have to put like a Formula One car outside like a building and go, oh, look, Formula One car. And then try and drag them in kicking and screaming. Or you didn't have to have like a football branded event for men to open up. But actually, there were ways that you could encourage men to speak through encouraging the right people to encourage them to talk. You mentioned the former Wales and Everton goalkeeper Neville Southall, who you would class as a big bloke. You know, he's a bloke. He's a footballing icon. He's a hero. He's a manly man. But actually, he's there talking about suicide. He talks about many different things through social media, which allows other men to almost legitimize their thoughts for it. But why do you need to legitimize those thoughts? Because you've grown up in a world where you've been told that you need to man up, that it's stiff upper lip, that it's keep calm and carry on. And those are the sort of dangerous things which I think, generationally, I think will go and will disappear eventually. But I think the danger for a lot of people, and I've spoken to many of them on the program, is that sometimes it takes a bereavement by suicide, or it takes a very serious mental health intervention in someone's life before they think, oh, I probably need to think about this. And I think we need to, we almost need to normalize those conversations much quicker, so that men feel straight away that they go, oh, I can talk about this. This is something that I can open up on. This is a conversation I can be part of, without thinking there's some sort of stigma that will carry with them as a result of it.
So on Twitter, every day for 12 months, I'd say thank you to the two people that take part. That means so many have taken part. And every day I'd do it. And after a bit, people would go, I do it because I get up early. Sharon, what's the update? And I'd think, oh, for God's sake, I'm going to London here. I haven't got time. So I could tell people anyway. Every day I went on. And then this particular day I went, right, you men, this is rubbish. We're getting thousands taking part. You're not taking part. You can't moan if you don't take part. And Neville Southall came on. He went, Sharon, take over my Twitter account. That will get you some men. I thought, oh, my God, how's this going to work? Men don't talk. I don't like football. And I'm talking about a taboo topic. 2 hours I had to go on. So it's a quite funny story. So I went on and I said to my friend, oh, do us a favour, come on. And then if no one talks to me, you can, you know, we'll have some kind of conversation. So I thought, right, okay, what shall I say? So I thought, right, I'll tell them about study. So I did a tweet. And I know you do Twitter. People don't read them in sequential order, do they? But I wasn't thinking this because I was nervous. So the next one, I thought, I'll tell them about myself. So I thought, right, okay. So I put, I've been personally bereaved by suicide and in 1990, and I lost my brother, age 29. Well, I was only on 20 seconds, and I felt very responsible. He gave me his passwords and everything, you know. I was like, yeah. Then I can't tell you, I think he's got 167,000 followers. Sorry about that, Big Nev. I didn't know you'd lost your brother. They thought Neville had disclosed on Twitter. And then he's going, oh, rest in peace. And I think, oh, no, God. So I contacted Neville and he went, Sharon. I said, shall I come off? Shall I come off? He says, if you can handle it, I can. Guess how many men filled in and said, after a bit, it was absolutely irrelevant because they all started talking then, so you couldn't shut them up. Guess how many men filled it in within 24 hours of me going on Twitter? Have a guess.
Oh, 125.
400. And that was because they thought, I thought, oh my God, I was on at 7 till 9. I thought at news at 10, it's going to disclose that Neville's disclosed he's lost his brother to suicide. It was me. And so, you know, the conversation started and everyone started saying, well, I lost my brother and I did this. And, you know, how powerful is that?
Absolutely.
You know,
actually, but it just goes to show as well that the responsibility that if you want to show it, and that was, you know, Big Nev in this case, and if you are a high profile figure, you can have these important conversations and be part of important conversations around suicide. We've seen this week, and I don't really want to get into this, Sharon, too much, because I think probably enough has been said on it. A very high profile figure on TV making dangerous and deeply concerning comments about suicide on national TV. And thankfully, the backlash against those comments, I think, will eventually, you know, put pay to some of the damage done by it. But it just goes to show, if you are in a position of authority, when you talk about issues like suicide, it has an impact. Now, that can either be good or that can be bad. But if you want to engage and you choose to engage, it can definitely be good and it can definitely be positive in terms of how other people will then engage with services in the future, in conversations in the future, in tackling stigma in the future. And I think credit to, you know, to Neville Southall for spotting that as something that he could help out on, and credit...
Yeah, every day from then on. And then he goes, Sharon, I'm sorry, I'm on my holidays next week, so what are we doing it? He totally emotionally invested in it. And he's my hero because, you know, we have got the largest sample of men bereaved by suicide, and they have told us how it is, and what a gift is that. So I want to say, because, you know, it's very easy to point fingers and blame people, because let me tell you, a lot of health professionals getting it wrong because they've not been trained. So I think It's easy to criticise and blame. It's an educational thing. What you're doing is very special. You're not just another podcast. You're educating people. You're giving permission for people to listen, to talk. I'll give you an example. On my Twitter account, I was getting people saying, I filled it in, Sharon, the survey, KISS. I'm thinking, oh, I don't know them. And then I get a man on, oh, I filled it in too, Sharon, KISS. And I'm thinking, what's going on? And then I realised, because I'm not embarrassed, because I'm not ashamed that I'm bereaved by suicide, because I dare talk about it, because it's about trying to help others, that I've kissed it, I've filled it in too, KISS, is the first time probably publicly that person's standing with everybody else. I had one clinician, I don't know how they managed to do this, fill the 72 questions in, uploaded it, you didn't need to, you only had to press a button, emailed it with my address. That was not a mistake. You know, that's probably the first time they've been able to talk. So we need to educate society. We need campaigns, you know, because you're absolutely right, a lot of damage is done. But, you know, I do believe this in life, out of everything bad in life, even me losing my brother, you can find some good. So what we have learned from this thing that's going on at the moment, let's educate. And it's not just the mental health professionals, it's the radio stations, TV, drug and alcohol services, because they don't expect to find a bereaved person. They think it's only about they're having a drink. You know, it's the prisons, emergency services, schools, universities, it's everywhere. And until we understand that it's this dark thread through society, but people, and this is really important, and you mentioned it really eloquently, the baton's passed. People don't even think of those bereaved by suicide. So they're the key, there's three aspects to suicide prevention: prevention, intervention, and looking after those bereaved by suicide. So we need to educate society that these people need looking after too.
Absolutely. And we've done a lot in terms of promoting some of those sort of suicide prevention tools, the resources that are out there in the training. Actually, some of the stuff that you talk about in the report is essentially the next step, actually post-suicide, that actually there is then a potential danger of increased suicide within the cohort of friends and family members. So we need to make sure that it's not just about preventing the suicide, a suicide in the first place, but also then having a system in place for when there is a suicide to get that training in place. 60%, according to the survey, didn't access support after being bereaved by suicide. One in five didn't know what was available. And in your recommendations, you talk about a national campaign. You talk about training. What for you, Sharon, should be a response to suicide? If there is somebody who is bereaved by suicide, should that be a direct response? Should that be a national service? What does the report recommend?
So I'm going to be fair. Up to about 6 years ago, the UK didn't even come out. When I'm doing my PhD, I was the only one in the country working in this field, and then ended up a few years later, you would fit in a broom cupboard. Now, I did a conference last year, over 700 people attended, so this is taking a lot of notice. We asked, as I said to you before, ask these people and what they want. The majority want to be approached. They want to be approached and offer of support. Let them decide if that's the right time, but they shouldn't have to go on the internet looking all over for everything. They want a person to approach them, or a service that is fit for purpose, that understands the vulnerability and needs. I would argue it should be multi-agency or somebody that can signpost them to resources, but we need to get in there. But what we've learned in this report that has really surprised us, so we know that these people are at risk of dying by suicide. We not naively assume, get in there quickly, we need to look after them. But what we're finding is, another peak time. It doesn't stop. Nearly a million people are bereaved by suicide each year, so they're a vulnerable high-risk group. But you don't become all right at 12 months. You become vulnerable again because you're living the first anniversary. So what we found with this, after the first anniversary, this is when they start engaging in the high-risk behaviour. But I would say if you get upstream, try and support these people, they might not start engaging in this drinking, the alcohol, you know. So there are many, many reasons. And if you don't care about this topic, let's get really, if you don't really care about it, you'd save money. because the longer you leave them, the more complex the problems are. So there is two drivers here. You can have this compassionate and caring thing that these people matter, or, you know, if you want to save money, get upstream and look after these people.
So, for instance, if there was a family who were bereaved by suicide, when they were organising the funeral, would there be sort of like an offer of an intervention at that point, leaflets and information about counselling services that are available, maybe an organised phone call between a counselling service and a family, and then information that could be shared potentially through the funeral or through social media, or however it would be shared, that would then mean that friends would also see it and have their feelings almost legitimized to think, oh, actually, yes, that is something that might affect me. Would that come from like a government body, do you think? How would that sort of exist?
At the moment, you'd need a wand. And what you've talked about is what these people need. And these people will get it, you know, because they have a right, you know, a right to do it. So you're absolutely right. These people are totally, the world, the assumptive world, everything is shattered and they need to feel empowered. These people, when you go to a family, you know, and say they've got children or young people, they don't have the luxury of doing, they have to tell their children, they don't know what to tell them. So some might not tell, and then the children find out at school because it's on the phones. You know, they need immediate support, or the young people or the friends, they need to know, the universities, the workplace. I mean, just referring to the radio stations, there's another radio station where they've lost someone to suicide. The workplace, they haven't got a clue what to do with these people. So in our report, 50% didn't get any offer of support. And those that did was bargain basement, wasn't fit for purpose. But this report and the research, we can tell them what these people need. Do you see what I mean? So it's all right, tick box exercise. Oh, yes, we've got that. No, they haven't. People, some charities, and I've got to say, do amazing work. But is it right and proper that we live in a postcode lottery? That you might have one good charity there and the others haven't. But I've got to be fair, the NHS long-term plan want a service across only in England now, so that everybody has a right to access to services. So this report will undoubtedly inform policy, practice and future services. But what's special as well in this, we've got the LGBT community have engaged in it. No, nothing about them, but we know they're at risk of dying by suicide. And like I say, oh, men are vulnerable to dying by suicide. Well, actually, people forget, men are also... a lot of them are bereaved by suicide as well. Do you see what I mean? So if you're a male, you're vulnerable, but also you're vulnerable because you've probably lost someone as well. So the BAME community have taken part. Only 3% of the sample, but let me tell you, 3% is better than 0%. Big deal, real big deal. And I feel honoured they've dared to take part in this. But we have to step up because... they've been silenced, all of these people, but they're not daft and they're watching, I think. And so,
in terms of the report now, it won't just sit on a shelf. Just tell us about what happens next in terms of the next conversations that you'll have, the conversations that you're trying to have and need to have. What sort of doors are opening up and what sort of doors need an extra bit of a shove?
Oh, well, you need a big... foot at the moment, to be honest. COVID, understandably so, as everything has stopped. Absolutely. I want to add as well, there's research now being done for people, because people are still bereaved by suicide in COVID. It's more complex. So there's this stigma associated with COVID, which is what we're learning at the moment. So they've got a double whammy. They've got, you know, if there's the COVID related and a suicide in the same family, they've got a double whammy there. So what I'm hoping to do is when you air this, I want to time it because I love your show and what you do. I'm going to share my presentation that I did at my launch, and I'm going to ask people, because sometimes more powerful, the people are more powerful than no money, but we have a lot, you know, when we come together and we've demonstrated the bereaved and the professionals have come together, I want them to share my presentation and the report, and I want them to share it with people of influence, power. It might be a headmaster, it might be a teacher, it might be your MP, and start talking about it on social media. And let's just see where that takes us, because we did this study without any funding, the largest internationally. Let's see what the little people can do with the help of people like you.
Well, we'll do our best to share it with as many people as possible. Sharon, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you and to talk about this really important issue as well. It's great to see, two and a bit years on from our conversation, that the report is very much sort of still alive and bringing new information to the fore all the time. The recommendations, I think, are achievable, very much so contained within it. I don't think there's anything in there which people would look at and go, well, that's not worth the hassle or not worth attempting. But I also think the lived experiences that are expressed within are also an eye-opener for a lot of people as well. So I think there's plenty in this as well. It's called From Grief to Hope, the collective voice of those bereaved or affected by suicide in the UK. We'll get a link to it up on our social media as well, so people can have a read through and read some of the executive summaries, but also some of the case studies and various different things that are contained within. Dr. Sharon, we will speak again, I'm certain of it, very soon.
Oh, thank you, Mick. Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.